Jonah, so? So, this afternoon we turn to upeksha. Upeksha, equanimity. The word has different meanings in different contexts. When you achieve the eighth stage out of nine stages leading to shamatha, at that point, neither laxity nor excitation, even on the subtle level, will arise, but not a problem anymore. And so at that point, you might recall, you don't need introspection. It's done its service, you give it a golden watch and retire it. Because now, with respect to introspection, the monitoring, the orthogonal interruption of the flow of mindfulness, you rest that in upeksha, equanimity, which means non-activation, non-intervention. Upeksha, just let it be. And introspection has no more work for the rest of shamatha. It's like you're rounding, if you're a baseball player, you're rounding third and it's just a slide into home. You know, you're pretty much finished, just slide into home. But there's nothing else to do. So that's one meaning of just non-intervention, non-activity, just being present. There's sorowatanyom, which is just the feeling, pleasure, pain, indifference. So upeksha is indifference, just a feeling of neutrality. And then there's the one we're cultivating. So we're not cultivating inactivity. We're not cultivating that. We're not cultivating just feeling indifferent. We're cultivating the fourth immeasurable, which you can achieve in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. You know, so something quite extraordinary. And so this, of course, can be understood in different ways. Just a brief review of the Theravada approach. I'm never setting this up as one is inferior, one is superior. They're different, and I keep on coming back to complementary, right? In the Theravada, the emphasis is really on, it is a feeling of wise equanimity, but it's wise equanimity. It's saturated with wisdom. It's recognizing the nature of situation and responding to it with a heart that is even, that is calm, that is just that, settled in equilibrium. The central theme that comes up in the Theravada teachings on the meditative cultivation of equanimity is reflection upon karma, nature of karma. There's cause and effect, cause and effect. And being aware of that then gives rise to a deep sense of calm with respect to whatever's coming up. Never to be mistaken with apathy or lack of caring. Bearing in mind the false facsimile, the near enemy of upeksha is what? Aloof indifference. So that looks like equanimity, and it's a far away from equanimity as self-centered attachment is to loving kindness. The outer veneer is similar. Besides that, they are totally different. So I was just kind of what cropped up. I mentioned to one person today that whenever I'm dishing things up just before the meditation, whether in the morning or afternoon, I'm really like a short order cook, like in a fast food joint. You know, I'm never, not once, and I have no intention for the rest of the retreat, spending time going, studying and preparing some notes and an outline and really trying to give the best little Dharma talk I can, like a real Dharma chef. I'm not. I'm not doing that. I'm a short order cook. So Carlos comes in, says, hey, give me some burger and fries. Coming up right away. You know? So I just go off and meditate, and then whatever comes up, I mean, I'm a short order cook. It comes up, I deliver. You know? So this is what came up. This is, you know, somebody called. And what came up was the serenity prayer. As soon as I start reading it, many of you will know it. You may or may not know it by its name. And I only learned this afternoon in my 2 minutes of short order cooking that it was composed during the Second World War by a Christian theologian with a very German name, Reinhold Niebuhr. But he's as American as a Nebraskan stalk of corn. He composed it during that time, very deep thinker, very deep Christian, but early phases of the Second World War. So one can imagine, I mean, I don't think none of us were adults at that, none of us were even remotely adults at that time. Probably most of us were even born at that time, I wasn't. But we can have some idea of the global drama that must have entailed. It must have been just staggering, you know, really feeling that your whole civilization is on the line. And so here it is all of four lines, the serenity prayer. Now, when we think of serenity, this is very, very close to what the Buddhists are referring to by upeksha. Serenity is even, calm, clear. Here's a serenity prayer. Lord, give me the strength to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. So many of you have heard it before. I just wanted to make sure I got it right. That's why I wrote it down. And that I knew where it came from, because it was kind of lingering in the back, but I didn't want to botch it. That really captures very much of the essence of the Theravada cultivation of Upeksha. Couched now, and what, calling it Lord? Well, why not? When, you know, in the Mahayana tradition, bless may the deity and the Lama and the deity bless me that I may such and such. So prayer is not at all alien to Buddhism by any means. But if we couch this in the context of karma, which is definitely where the Theravada teachings on Upeksha, where they are couched, very deep, very deep. It's attending to causality and recognizing there's some things that are drastically in need of change, like it would have been good if Hitler just went home and had some major therapy, you know, in 1939. That would have been great. He really needed some very deep therapy, maybe medication. But he didn't get it, right? And so, but then there's things, and the, you know, that, well, just so many cases where you see there's a dire need for change, and then you look, and there's so much momentum behind a certain current, a flow, a sequence, that you see, there's nothing I can do. I can't turn that back. So, of course, I could go on and on about karma, but I think I'd like to just make one point, because the easiest mistake about karma is to interpret it in terms of a kind of fatalism. This, oh, what can you say? You know, what can you say? It's this person's karma. They just have to deal with it. It's just their karma. And then just and go into aloof indifference, as if karma is somehow up in the sky, and it just, you know, like it's fate. It's like a destiny. And it just drops on people like a lead brick. Karma, of course, is completely dynamic. It's effervescent. It's ongoing. It is the ongoing creation of the future in the present, as we're sowing seeds every moment. Sowing seeds, we are creating our future individually and collectively. And there we are. We are holding the reins. It's not Buddha. It's not God. It's not fate. It's not atoms. It's not brains. It's here we are. So this ties in very much with the morning. Here we are. We are creating our future. And we can create it with wisdom or without wisdom. If we have wisdom, then we have that choice to draw from it. But where does karma come in? And that is, are our present choices, the decisions we make, are they influenced by the past? If they weren't, we'd be imbeciles. That would be crazy. I'm like, what? Like, we're just born today, and then we just start making choices as if the past never happened. That would be a type of insanity or imbecility. So of course it should be, must be, has to be, influenced by the past. And yet, unequivocally, absolutely according to the Buddhist teachings, not simply predetermined. Not predetermined. Absolutely not. But the one point, it's the slender point, that I thought might be worth sharing, is in the Buddhist understanding of karma. Here we are, we're ongoing creating it now. Right now we are creating, influenced by the past. But right now is where the power is, and that's where we're creating the future. But are there some things that haven't yet happened that are inevitable? Are the things that haven't happened that will inevitably happen and there's nothing you can do about it? And the answer is yes. In Buddhism, yes. It does happen. So, I don't know why, you know, but there was a dramatic scene in the movie, came out, must have been 20 years ago. Remember Thelma and Louise? These two ladies? And at the end, if you haven't seen it, I'm about to ruin the movie for you. These two gals, they're looking at, they've given up hope, like everything behind them is what they don't want. They're going to go to jail. And so they're driving along their car out in the desert, and they got the cops behind them. And if they go back, they're going to go for a long prison sentence. Bad news, they're not up for it. So they just hit the accelerator as they're heading out over the desert, heading for a big cliff, like a Grand Canyon kind of cliff. And they're zipping towards it. You know, it's dirt, and they're just hitting the accelerator. They're going 50, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour heading towards the cliff. Now, when they're still a quarter of a mile away from the cliff, let's say it's Thelma driving and Louise is in the passenger seat. They get about a quarter of a mile away from the cliff. then Louise might say, Thelma, honey, I don't think I want to die. Why don't you just hit that brake and let's just take the prison some, because we'll get out after a while. So hit the brake right now, honey. She could say that. And if you've got a quarter of a mile ahead of you, she could hit the brake. And then they could just be caught and go to prison and then get out and live the rest of their life. It's not too late. But imagine Louise there sitting in the passenger seat, and she's getting right, and they're 50 feet away from the cliff. 50 feet away from the cliff, and they're driving at 90 miles an hour on dirt in a car. 50 feet away. And she says, Thelma, honey, hit the brake. I don't want to die. And Thelma says, too late, honey. It doesn't matter what we do now. You're 50 feet away, and you're driving 90 miles an hour. It doesn't matter what you do. You can turn sideways, hit the brake, hit the accelerator, pray to God, pray to the devil. It doesn't matter what you do. You're going over that cliff. Hasn't happened yet. But there's nothing you can do at all in any way that's going to prevent you from going over that cliff. All the causes and conditions are necessary, and there's nothing in nature that's going to stop it. And so at that point, you could be a prophet. I predict that within a very short time, Thelma and Louise are going to go over that cliff. I was right. I must be a prophet. Right? The causes and conditions were there. Sufficient causes and conditions were there to the point there's no possibility of averting it. And they're going over the cliff. So there are situations like that in history. People speak of the tipping point with respect to global warming. If the tundra starts thawing big time, they say that's going to just release so many gases that you can just sit back and then basically watch it happen. Because there can be some big, big changes if we get to that point. I don't know much about the global warming, but I've heard that one. There's so much of it, and so much gases and stuff stored in the frozen tundra, that if that melts, that's going to be a tipping point. So it's said. So there's various tipping points in various ways. And once you've gone beyond the tipping point, whether you're speaking from the perspective of environmental studies, ecology, or Buddhism, there's a point in which it's just going to happen. So, Lord, give me the strength, right, to accept the things I cannot change. When we see things out of control or momentum taking place, whether it's in the economy, whether it's a child who's gotten in with the wrong group, just the kind of kids you would desperately hope they'd never come under the influence of, and they're in it, the group has them, and they're doing the stuff that is self-destructive, whether it's drugs, it's violence, whatever it is. And you can look and say, is there anything I can do? And there may not be. There may not be. You can always kill your child. That would stop things, but that's not a solution. So it could be that. I mean, you can imagine a parent, and it's happened to so many parents, looking at that and saying, there's nothing I can do. This is a young adult now. Or many other cases, a disease that it's on its route, and there's just no turning it back apart from divine intervention. It's not going to happen. Friend of mine who died of bone cancer, that's an irreversible trip. You don't go uphill on that one. It just gets worse. Right? And so in those cases where we see the momentum's up and it's going to come to its own fruition, it will come to its own fruition. Can we learn from it? Can we transform it into Dharma? Because the one thing we can't do is make it not happen. Having the strength to look at those inevitable sequences where the outcome is not something you'd wish for. You say, all right, but this too can be transformed. Having the strength to accept things we cannot change, the courage to accept to change things that we can. That's where the semshuk, we had a whole conversation in the last training. Sisu. Heidi told me, the one word I know in Finnish. The one word, I don't even know yes or no. But sisu I know, and that's semshuk in Tibetan, the strength of your heart. The strength of your heart. And so having that sisu, when you see there's a possibility of changing, this is where compassion comes in. Seeing there's a possibility of intervening and really alleviating suffering, avoiding suffering, helping out. And having the courage, the semshuk, not just falling into sadness, despair, and all of that, but bringing forth the sisu, the semshuk, the strength of your heart, the courage. It's not a bad, it's pretty close. To change the things that we see really should need to be changed, can be changed, doing it. And then equanimity comes in with the wisdom to know the difference. It's a beautiful prayer. So short. So short. So that's the Theravada take. That's the Theravada take. To a large extent, I was just mentioning that to somebody in one of the one-on-one meetings today. To a large extent in Theravada, that the very image of equanimity is one that is up at the top of the pinnacle. If you look, go to Myanmar, go here, go to Sri Lanka, look at some of the photos of the greatest adepts, the great yogis of the Theravada tradition. Just look how they're depicted. It's usually even. Look. Equanimity. Gone beyond. Cooled from the flames of samsara. Cooled. Calm. If they go astray, they fall into aloof indifference. But the whole Theravada tradition knows that is a false facsimile. But it's calm. It's imbued with wisdom. An imperturbability there. One never, ever flies off the handle. The emotional vacillations. History. So that's Theravada. And then we have Mahayana. The approach. And now once again, as usual, for all four of them, rather than cultivating an emotion, and one could say this is something of an emotion. It is a wise equilibrium. It certainly has an emotional quality to it. In the Mahayana, it turns once again into an aspiration. Into an aspiration. May all sentient beings be free of attachment to those who are near, and abide in. May all sentient beings abide in the equanimity that is free of attachment to those who are near and aversion to those who are far, that we regard as distant, alien, other, on the other side. So once again, the metaphor of the degree of magnification may be helpful. Remember, for loving kindness, not looking just at the surface, not penetrating so deeply you've gone into emptiness, but finding the right zoom degree, the right degree of penetration, of magnification, of attendance, right? That you see, there's the lovable person. There's the lovable person. You're not looking at skin, you're not looking at emptiness, you're finding a lovable person. And frankly, it's so often easiest with little kids. Because you're not, unless you're a parent or somehow related to them, you probably won't feel a lot of attachment. I see other people's children, I really basically never feel attachment for them. But you can certainly, feel loving kindness for them. Gosh, a little kid, what do you do? So as with loving kindness, so with equanimity, finding the proper degree of magnification, where are you going to focus? Where are you going to focus? And so when we are moving in the same ruts of the past, of just going out into the world and say, okay, who's pleasing and who's unpleasing and who do I not care about? Who's done something good for me, bad for me, and who hasn't touched me? Okay, let's go. What's up? What's up? Oh, pleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, 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 pleasant, neutral, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant. So there we go. I it all the way across, full bandwidth of its, whole bunch of pleasant its, unpleasant its, and then don't care its, right? So what's that? Total superficiality. It's as if you're in a lucid dream and you recognize everybody is just a figment of your imagination. Right? It's just surfaces. Pleasant surface, unpleasant surface, indifferent surface. And it's not just face and nose and lips and so forth. It's also behavior. Pleasant behavior, unpleasant behavior, neutral behavior. It's all surfaces. And so there we are, the final, dehumanization of everybody around us. Because we turn them all into flat surfaces. It's a flat earth approach to viewing not only human beings, sentient beings. So there it is. And that's where all the attachment and aversion comes from. Pleasant object, unpleasant object, neutral object. Like, don't care. It's all surface. It's all surface. So clearly, if we're going to develop the equanimity in this Mahayana mode, developing an equally caring heart, then part of this is going to be the viewing with the eyes of wisdom to penetrate through the surface, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral surface. Because that's just attachment and aversion and indifference. We have to penetrate through that. But this is not penetrating so deeply that we're just going into empty of inherent nature, empty of inherent nature, empty of inherent nature. Because if you're attending to emptiness of inherent nature, you're not attending to a sentient being anymore. Right? So that's not equanimity, that's just realization of emptiness. So once again, if we stay on the surface, that's too superficial. If we go into ontological analysis, right, we've gone too deep. Yeah, you're experiencing equanimity, but that's not the equanimity of sentient beings. That's just space, right? Something like that. And so where's the proper degree of magnification? Beyond the veneer of attractive and unattractive, both physical form, behavior, and so forth, not so deep that we're tapping into emptiness, identitylessness. So not too shallow, not too deep, just deep enough. And I think the deep enough comes from the conversation with Carlos when asking, how do we view terrorists? On the surface, can't stand them. They scare me. Maybe I'm not probably of their religion. That means I'm probably don't matter. They probably wouldn't mind killing me at all. They might even prefer it. So there's surface. But then how far do we go? As we're penetrating in, almost like peeling off layers of dead skin, right? Because the outer is dead after all. Go deeply enough that as we're tending to whether it's a terrorist or whether it's a supermodel or a fantastic, incredibly hot hunk. Did that sound just too weird? I'm trying to think like a woman. I'm not really good at it, but, you know. It's like whatever the women say about a man they find really attractive. I was trying. Okay, good, good. I've heard hot. Somebody told me hot is the word you use, right? But in any case, it's surfaces once again. You know, it's the gorgeous babe. It's the incredibly handsome man. So to that level, clearly going deeper than that, because frankly, neither one is like me at all, not from my perspective, not so deeply, but finding someone there in the incredibly attractive person or the person for whom we just feel a lot of attachment, and the person we'd really have a lot of attachment, please go far away on the planet as possible. And if you want to go to another planet, that's fine by me. But really be gone. That kind of like really aversion. Cutting through that, in both cases, the object of attachment, the object of aversion, and penetrating through deeply enough, but not too deeply, to finding a person like yourself. Like yourself. You can look. You just look the person. I mean, in the meditative practice, mentally looking at the person in the eyes, say, "Yeah, I see you. I see you. I see me." And that brings us back to loving kindness. This is the wheel of Dharma. Because if you respond to yourself with just aversion. On those occasions where you fail to live up to your expectations, disappointed yourself, feel you're really pretty cruddy, kind of a loser, and you feel this person is like yourself, I'm a loser, you're probably a loser too. You know? Or if you're really infatuated with yourself, think you're something really special, superior, and all of that, then maybe you'll try to, you know, inflate this other person. Oh, join me. You know, I'm on the winning team. So clearly for this equanimity, the culmination of the four, to come to its flowering, it has to be really like a wheel of Dharma, as the loving kindness holds hands with compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. Equanimity has to hold hands with loving kindness. Otherwise you just wind up flat indifference, or yeah, you're a lot like me and I don't really like myself, or I just think I'm so special, I'm fantastic. And so then it's just back to attachment and aversion, all over again, back to square one. So, all of these dovetail into themselves. But if we can attend closely enough that we see someone essentially like ourselves, and if we can attend closely and see that person like ourselves is lovable, then welcome to the land of Upeksha. You've made it home. Because this is the culmination of the four immeasurables. Boundless equanimity. Okay, let's practice. Settle your body in the equilibrium, the balance. Poised with a deepening sense of relaxation, balanced with a posture of vigilance, sustained with stillness. Settle your inner speech, the inner commentary, in its natural state. Effortless, but not effortlessly commenting. Effortlessly silent. Poised in a balance by way of the respiration that comes to settle in its own equilibrium. Between being forced, being effortful, and being constricted or inhibited. Find the balance. Settle your mind in equilibrium with an ever-deepening sense of relaxation, looseness, sense of ease, balance with clarity, vividness, luminosity, sustained with stability. Balance your mind for a little while with mindfulness of breathing. It's important to know what is the object of mindfulness in the meditative cultivation of equanimity. It is sentient beings. It is not emptiness. It is not space. It is not appearances to your own mind. It's your fellow sentient beings who, like yourself, unlike appearances to the mind, wish for happiness, wish to be free of suffering. We attend to sentient beings by way of our memories, mental images. But the object of sentient beings. Attend first of all, if you will, to someone in the middle, straight ahead, for whom, in terms of the dichotomy of attachment and aversion, you don't feel much of either. Very easy to feel superficial equanimity. But now go beyond the surface, the indifferent surface. Attend closely to the sentient being like yourself. And as you attend closely, with each in-breath arouse a yearning, may you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. With each out-breath, may you find genuine happiness and the causes of happiness. Breathe in and breathe out as before. the appearance of this person dissolve back into the space of the mind. To your left, you may attend now to a person for whom you feel strong attachment, this self-centered attachment. And allow that attachment to arise as you attend to the surface, these very attractive qualities. Ones that make you feel good. And now look more deeply beyond the I-it relationship to the sentient being who's looking back. And practice as before. Let the appearance fade back into the mind. And to your right, bring to mind a person, if there is one, whether a personal acquaintance or someone you know only by way of the media, for whom you feel aversion. Bring this person again vividly to mind and attend to the surface. Allow the aversion to arise. now look beyond the surface to someone just like yourself, equally deserving of finding happiness, and practice like before. Let this appearance too fade back into the space of the mind. And now for a little while, let your attention rove to individuals or groups, to those who are near and far, and practice as before. release all appearances and let your awareness rest in equilibrium. So two very short practical questions. One is a suggestion, the other is a request. The summary of the four measurables, the poster on the bulletin board in Spanish, do you have it in English? Does anybody have that handy? Anybody have it handy in English? Do you have it already printed in English? Anybody have that? You know, the chart, the four measurables and the near enemies, the four enemies and all of that. Nobody has it? Okay, then I do. Then I will ask Kun U to... What shall I have? Just ask him to post it. Best to post it rather than give it to you, then you'll need to memorize it. Okay? But sure, I'll take care of that. Be glad to. And then, we're right now midstream. A little tiny bit more than 3 weeks left. So now is really midstream of this time we have together, our retreat hyphen expedition. So clearly a time to make best use of our time here. This incredible. I've heard more than one person say today, I heard it again, but I've heard it before. People who've done a lot of retreats in Asia and the West and so forth, and more than two people have come to the conclusion this is just the best retreat center they've ever been at. And since I have nothing to do, I had nothing at all to do with creating it, I can say, yeah, I agree. There's no self-praise there. And so here it is. It's hard to imagine, to my mind, getting much better than this. So to take full advantage of that, and this being really centrally a shamatha practice with a very, very powerful addition of the four measurables, you might recall, if you've not forgotten, that talking tends to really add to OCDD. So if you can keep on coming back to default mode, just if in doubt, silence, if in doubt, silence. There are certain areas, maybe the bulletin board area, who knows where. Again, I've never wanted there to be a strict injunction against speaking, because sometimes going off to a quiet place for a walk, so on occasion I'll walk with somebody if there's something really meaningful, somebody wants to speak with me, I'll go for a walk on occasion. And of course, 2 hours a day, 6 days a week. But overall, I think our conversations are very meaningful. So when you see it's really meaningful, then by all means, then it's your choice. But do try to go to a place where other people don't hear you. And my apologies to Victoria, because I think you must be hearing a lot of the conversations. You can't hear the... If the wall between our room is the same as other... You won't be able to tell what we're saying, but you can probably go, wah, wah, wah. You probably hear that something. In any case, if we can just bear this in mind, out of courtesy to everyone here, and the level of courtesy has been very high, but if you'd like to speak, that you go off to a quiet place, and if in doubt, default mode, silence, maintain that flow of mindfulness, and do as little as possible to throw oil on the fire of OCDD while we're here. So I was asked to make that suggestion and happy to do so. So I'm finished. Any questions, especially about practice? Or should we have it an early afternoon? that di 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 di. Okay, Paola.
It's about awareness of awareness.
Yes.
When I'm doing the oscillation, mm-hmm. and I invert the attention, I have noticed that I have a lot of tension in my face and also in the chest.
Uh-huh.
And when I release it, it's fine, but I don't know how to disengage the body.
Right. Obviously, too much effort. So again, I think roughly 95% of the problems that arise are coming because of too much effort. Right? And so, if you can like it, so it, but it's delicate. Because on the one hand, the words are, this is straight from Padmasambhava, now focus, now concentrate. You know, he's saying, now it's time to flex your muscle, to really focus now. And whether it's just in the experience of awareness, of consciousness, whether it's probing in on the observer, probing in on the agent who's releasing, it is definitely a time. But if we bring in too much muscle, then we just start getting the tension, constriction at the heart, constriction in the head. Many people, it's in the head. So to simply try to make it more slender. It is concentrating, but it's concentrating in a very fine way. And here's what I would suggest in terms of what the retraction is. It's not, okay, now I'm going to bring my awareness into the center of my head. That's a good way to get a headache, you know? So it's not into the head. It's not into any body part. I mean, there is a point, as we'll see in tomorrow's practice, the final phase, of letting, see if you can let your awareness descend into the heart and have that as, if your awareness were the light on a lighthouse, you know, that shines out over the ocean, if your awareness were a lighthouse, the light in the lighthouse would be shining from your heart, okay? But it's soft, it's gentle. But for the and that's one particular practice, and we'll go up, right, left, down, to the heart and out to space, so we'll do our whole gymnastic routine tomorrow. But for the broader theme of release and withdrawal, rather than thinking into the head or into the heart, it's rather simply withdrawing away from all appearances. Now your head, when you feel your head, like tactile sensations in the head, can you feel your head right now? You nodded. Yeah. And then you can feel the sensations in the head when you nod. I still got one. Yeah. That too is an appearance. That too is an appearance. Whatever sensations there are of the face, the teeth, anything, that's an appearance. So, away. We're pulling away from all appearances. And so, it's just a withdrawal from all appearances, just away from all appearances, like, bye-bye, the train is leaving, coming right into its nature. So it's not spatially located. It's not into the center of the head. It's not to the eyes. It's not anywhere. It's just away from any deliberate attention to appearances or objects of any kind. Now, what's the real solution? The real solution is the build-up to awareness of awareness. And that is, if you've been doing a lot of mindfulness of breathing, especially at the tummy, rise and fall of the abdomen, getting really mellow, nice, jelly belly, even if you're really slender, little slender jelly belly, you know. So you may not have much fat there, but it's just soft, really soft, you know. So even a little breath comes out, you know, like that. Really soft belly, really soft, gentle awareness, relaxing, relaxing, relaxing. Just do that for, you know, 100 hours or so. Get into the theme of real soft, but nevertheless not spacing out, not, you know, like that. Being present, but very gently so. And then, very delicately, and now, again, always these words, delicate, soft, slender, delicately bring your attention up to the apertures of the nostrils, and doing it so quietly, it's as if your breath doesn't even notice. You know, kind of quietly slipping in the back door. Nobody's looking? Okay. And so, there you are, only you notice, but the body didn't notice, right? Just the nose notices that, oh, somebody's paying attention, getting more vivid sensations at the apertures of the nostrils. It's slender, and then you don't get any buildup of pressure. None in the cheeks, not in the head. Maybe you sometimes feel a big nose, Like you have a big nose, because prana comes to the nose. But it's not really unpleasant, and it's not going to lead to a migraine headache. It might make your nose a little bit bigger, though. I don't know. That's an experiment to be tested. We'll watch. We'll do a longitudinal study. Do your nose really get bigger? So, maybe not. Maybe you should only try it after you've gone through adolescence. You know, then. So, that's slender. And then you'll know you're doing it right when it's getting sharper, clearer, stability, relaxation, all of that is going smoothly. You're spending, you know, an hour, you're doing spending 6, 7, 8 hours a day focusing there. And there's just no problems. Right at the apertures of the nostrils. It's like a laser coming in. And you're just not seeing any downside at all. And you are getting relaxed and all of that. Good. You're doing that practice right. And then now, but you had a target. Tactile sensations of the breath. You got a real target there, right? And now, but when you can do this with no buildup of pressure, then, and I'm doing this very sequentially, you know, just showing why each of these stages are there. You may go directly to settling the mind and find, at least there's one, more than one person here that just, you know, actually settling the mind works better than mindfulness of breathing, and I don't get the pressure building up in the head, and I don't have the problems, and I don't feel uptight. Great. You don't have to do every single step. But every single step is there because it may be useful. And then settling the mind in its natural state, and again bringing that spacious quality, above all a spacious quality, to whatever arises in this subspace of the mind. But again, not feeling pressure building up in the head, not feeling tightness, not feeling the breath is getting constricted. The breath flowing like the body doesn't even know you're meditating, just like you're going to fall asleep, you know? And then getting that lighter and lighter touch. A number of you still finding that when you're observing thoughts and so forth, they tend to get extinguished as soon as we take note of them. Well, that's normal. But it also shows that we're touching a bit too hard. Okay, I've told a number of you individually the bashful maiden, the old parable of the bashful maiden with the young player, the young, you know, young man, ladies man, peering with intense gaze upon the bashful maiden, and she slips away. She immediately runs, you know, she's bashful. She doesn't like that kind of intense attention focused on her. And so your thoughts being the bashful maiden that slip away as soon as your intense gaze focuses on them, but then getting softer and softer, a lighter and lighter touch. Oh, and again, my favorite image, and I've told many of you, and I said it again today, the old man, the old woman watching other people's children play. Very soft. And the children, they just see an old person over there. They don't care. You're not my grandpa. You're not my mom. You don't matter. I'm going to just play. You know. So the thoughts just play. And your attention is so soft, so light, yet interested. Because the old man likes watching little children play. The old woman likes watching children. It's fun to watch. Yeah? So when you can do that, that you've gotten, you know, so getting really, it's just getting familiarization. Getting more and more familiar with it. That you can even watch thoughts arising and passing, just arising and passing in the space of the mind. From that vantage point, when you have that degree of the balance of relaxation and clarity, yeah, because you're not spacing out, you're not doping out, you are knowing something. In all of these cases, you're knowing something. Then if you go from there to, first of all, do exactly what Padmasambhava said. Because again, he's so kind to us, giving all these stages, even in awareness of awareness. And I've not given, but he gave a whole sequence of shamatha practices before awareness of awareness. I'm giving you the most difficult one. But he gives his own sequence, starting by looking at a stick, a stone, or a flower. You know, that's not too hard. Got it. Yeah, what's next? You know, and so he gives a nice sequence going from coarse to subtle, but the subtlest is awareness of awareness. But remember the way he starts. And just, okay, now just sit there. Don't look at anything. Just sit there. Let your awareness come into space. Just sit there. Okay, I can do that. Next. You know, it's not that hard. Okay, just sit there. Don't do anything. Don't focus on anything. Okay, got it. And you just sit there, and after a while, I mean, really, it may be a matter of seconds, you're just sitting there, and something becomes clearer that was there in the deep background, but now kind of slips gently into the foreground. And that is, whoa, I'm not dead. And that's just one way of phrasing it. But whoa, awareness. Wow. Keeps on happening. Awareness of awareness. And when it's just like that, you saw, I mean, I was doing a little bit of play acting, but not much. In that, it was just so casual, like, but interested. Like, this is what it is to be aware. This is what it is to be a sentient being in this universe, huh? Wow. It's much more interesting in a way if one really gets the clarity of it. The awareness can actually be more interesting than anything that is appearing to it. I think it almost suggests to you, I'm deep. Awareness itself, as is speaking to you, I'm deep. You're looking into a deep pool here. Someone spoke to me today, one can speak deep, one can speak expansive. Either way, they're both two very good metaphors. But when you're just sitting there and suddenly you're struck with simplicity, not all the little stuff, and there's a lot of little stuff. Samsara is just composed of a whole bunch of little stuff. And it all passes. And when it's passed, there's more little stuff. And that passes, and there's more little stuff. And then you're dead. And then you get more little stuff. It's just one thing after another, you know. And it doesn't go anywhere. But you slip into this simplicity where you aren't going anywhere, which means you're not going in circles. If you're not going anywhere, you're not going in circles. You're not going anywhere. But you're not stagnating either. You're looking into a deep pool. You're looking into, you can think looking down like looking into a deep pool, like a well, or looking up and saying, whoa, that's big. Into the starry sky. That can actually be more interesting than anything that appears. And when you have that, again, it gets, I hardly ever use the word, because it's used so often, it gets a little bit tiresome. But a sense of wonder. You know? So I haven't used it yet, so maybe it's not a cliche in this retreat anyway. But, whoa. Wow. And then one can turn that into a verb. I wonder where this will go if I don't go. What is this going to lead to when I'm not going anywhere? It's really loose. It's really loose. It's light. But it's interested. Really interested. And when you're there, then to set up the oscillation, you're not going to find the tightness. Okay. So that was a very long-winded way of saying, let yourself build up to it. And then if you let success build on success, you were able to tend to the tamayi, no problems. Then to the nostrils, no problem. Settling the mind, space of the mind. Awareness of awareness. No problem, no problem. Check, 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 check. And then you go here, yeah. It's so light, there's no tightening, no constriction. So I hope by when we come to the eighth week, you'll have your checklist of 20 little boxes. Check, check, check. 20 boxes checked, as in can do. That would be my aspiration, can do. And then it's your choice whether you want to do them, but at least you know you can do, okay? Jolly good. The Shamatha Project, one of the tasks that the meditators were given, some of you will remember, when they're doing their hours of measurements in the lab, they had two labs running concurrently. I thought, all right, now just settle in your, what did they call it? You settle in your ordinary state, but what do they call it? Not ordinary state. They weren't speaking of a meditative state, just go into neutral. You just finished one task, we're about to give you another task. And now there was a slogan they used. It really became like a mantra. And now just go into ordinary. Don't do it, just go into ordinary. Write that, remember? It was a really nice phrase. In fact, they even put it on T-shirts or something, I think, that little phrase. But it was, they wanted your baseline. When you're not cultivating compassion, not practicing mindfulness of breathing, not doing this, not doing that, just baseline. And now we're going to ask you to start doing something, but we need a baseline. We need to do measurements in baseline, right? It would be very interesting to, I think they did, note how does the baseline change from the day you arrive, because they pretty, I think you had, a day or two to rest, and then you started having measurements when people first came to the Shamatha Project up there in Colorado. But what is your baseline when you're just, when you're not sitting there not doing anything? Are you just slipping immediately into semi-conscious OCDD? That's baseline. This is what I normally do. Blah, 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 blah. You want me to start now? Okay, what? And then I'm finished? Oh, good. Blah, 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 blah. There's baseline for a lot of people, right? And that's why they have all those old newspapers in doctor's offices, because the newspapers are, those old magazines are more interesting than blah, 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 blah. Then you go, then you have a dialogue with blah, blah, blah. Somebody else's blah, blah interfaces with your blah, blah, and there you go. So there's one type of baseline. But as the weeks went by, and I sensed it was true just in that little interval there, what was your baseline when there were no hands up, nobody talking? What was your baseline? What did you just fall back into? And I'm not asking everybody to answer, but it might be interesting to note, now that you've been here for 5 weeks, when nothing's happening, where do you go? And you may find the place to go back to is really not that bad. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. Welcome to have been here for 5 weeks. Baseline's pretty okay. Pretty okay. Gets better and better. Better and better. So, any other questions, comments, insights, experiences you'd like to share? I felt like an auction. I thought, was that a bid, Patricia? Microphone's coming. Yeah. I felt like an auctioneer. Do I hear? Question. Do I hear a question?
My question was related to her question, so it's already answered.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yes, Jennifer.
What happens with your brain when you're visualizing something, your eyes are shut? Does your visual cortex light up?
My understanding is yes. I think there must be at least two people in the room that know better than I, because I've never had any formal training, never sought any formal training in neuroscience. But I certainly, over 18 years, certainly spent a lot of time in the same room with neuroscientists. And my understanding from Stephen LeBerge also, he and I have done 6 workshops, 10-day workshops together, and he knows a good deal about the brain. And my understanding is that, for example, in dreaming, so I'll report then, and then if Ahedi and Joachim can add anything further, or if I make any mistake, absolutely don't feel bashful, just jump right in, then I'll learn something. But what I do recall from Stephen LeBerge, who's really quite an expert on dreaming and the neurophysiology of dreaming, is that when you're dreaming and you're in the midst of a whole visual scene, the visual cortex is very much involved. It lights up, so to speak, which is to say there's a lot of activity in the visual cortex. Even though your eyes are closed and your retina is not doing any work at all, and presumably the optic nerve isn't doing anything at all. No message is coming in and out. It's, you know, shop is closed. But it's all being internally generated. And the visual, my understanding is, yes, the visual cortex is very active. And I've heard it said, and I think this is, again, based upon good research, that overall, the brain is, if this is not just gibberish, if anything, the brain is more active when you're dreaming, when you're fully involved in a full-fledged dream. The brain is even more active in the dream than it is in the waking state. if that's possible, if that even means anything, but it's certainly not kind of slumbering or idling or something like that. Even in deep sleep, of course, a lot is happening in the brain. But in dreaming, where you're having the full-fledged emotions, so you can imagine all the parts of the brain, whether it's the amygdala, the hippocampus, whatever it may be, that are strongly correlated with emotion, with desires, hopes, and fears, and so forth. Are they going to be activated in a dream? Absolutely, yes. Right? Because these are the neural correlates, the neural bases of the emotions, of a wide variety of quasi-sensory, since it's now all internally generated, but yeah, a whole lot of activity of the visual cortex. It would raise an interesting question whether one can still dream with mental imagery if the visual cortex, you definitely can dream with a lot of visual imagery if your eyeball is damaged. That's no question. You definitely can. But if somehow you had some accident or a tumor or aneurysm or something, a stroke that did severe, large-scale damage in the visual cortex, I believe it's back here to the left in the back, if that were major damage to the visual cortex, could you still, so much so that you became blind, and that's certainly possible, if you became blind because of damage to the visual cortex, could you still dream with visual imagery? And now I've just run out of knowledge. It didn't take long, did it? Hedy or Joachim, anything to fill in here? And if I said anything incorrect, please just jump right in. You know? Because I think you both know more about the brain than I do. Okay, microphone coming. Thank you.
I will check the answer about the visual cortex and the damage of of area. How much needed to be damaged if the case is like that, that
right.
you don't have visual consciousness?
One simple question would be, if the visual cortex is sufficiently damaged that you just lose sight, you become blind. Just that. That's a simple question. I presume it's a simple question. Seems pretty simple to me. It's yes or no. Then if it's sufficiently damaged so that you cannot see anything, can you still dream with full visual imagery? That'd be an interesting question. I have no idea what the answer is. Yeah. And I think I don't even know enough to want to posit in, because I don't have enough information to give a really informed guess. So somebody knows, and it would be very interesting to know. Yeah. Yes. Oh, we have more experts here. Excellent. I get a break. We have other people in knowledge.
I am hardly an expert in this, but I took a course on it, and so I know a little bit about it. I read a couple of articles.
Yeah.
So yes, if your visual cortex is really damaged, you stop dreaming in the way you did. So it depends on how damaged it is. Sometimes weird things happen, like it gets enough damage so that you can't dream in first personal perspective.
Yeah.
You can just watch yourself from afar.
Yeah,
and weird stuff like that. But if it's really damaged, you can't imagine and you can't dream. And in fact, the visual cortex is very related to imagining.
Of course, yeah.
To the point where it's been proven that, that people can't really distinguish with a great deal of precision between imagining and perceiving things.
Yeah. You're saying generally or?
Generally.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is where people see things that never occurred, hear things that never happened.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Hear sounds that never happened and so forth. So it's not only visual, it's auditory. The classic one is somebody screaming fire in the midst of a crowded auditorium and then getting everybody's reports of what exactly happened in the pandemonium. And you get a whole bunch of different reports, many of them lightly touching reality, and the rest was all imagination.
Exactly. And an interesting thing, just adding to what you said, is that, yeah, in fact, when we're dreaming, the brain is very much activated.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that the emotional brain is activated, but the frontal cortex, which is sort of on top of that part of the brain, when you're in a non-lucid dream, it's very much deactivated.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And when you become lucid, all your reasoning activates.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Acha.
So I have a small request, since we have time. And it's, can Heidi talk to us about Sisu?
Oh.
Because last retreat was so inspiring, and I would love for all the people here in the podcast to be able to benefit from this. It's great.
Sure. Just before we put a cap on this, anything to add, Joachim, about the proceeding? Good.
Yes, I think it's good to be clear about that there is actually not an emotional brain.
Right.
The brain is like the connective
distributed
networks. Yeah. So it's not there's not a place in the brain where just emotions are processed. The whole brain is activated.
But there are. Is it not the amygdala and the hippocampus that are strongly correlated with?
Yeah, they're stronger. Yeah, there's certain areas that are stronger correlated with emotions.
Much more than the brain stem, for example, or the.
Yeah, but for example, the amygdala is also activated in cognitive function or vigilance and stuff like that. So it's also a part of other functions.
I've heard so much neuroscience and I've retained so little. But if I recall correctly, the amygdala is quite centrally located and it's connected with an awful lot of brain functions. Is that correct? That's what I thought, yeah. So interesting, yeah. Jolly good. Thank you. And Heidi, if you will enlighten us. It really was very inspiring, and I'm delighted to turn it over to Heidi. The word is Sisu, S-I-S-U. It's Finnish, and Heidi is an expert.
Okay, so this is about really from the first person perspective about the Sisu. I learned from Alan that Sisu is same as a Semsuk.
Semsuk.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the definition is same as we have in Finland, and the Sisu is the kind of the basic element in our nationality. And what I have learned about Sisu is when I was a child, my mother told me that I have a Sisu in my heart. I guess that was the first one I really recall that something is kind of part of my personality, and maybe I was 3 or 2 years old. And she told me that the Sisu is the power of the heart that you just never give up. In any situation, you don't have any possibility to give up because you have such a strength in your heart. And I guess that's the case because I don't know any other kind of possibility to think about it. So, and of course, you can cultivate Sisu in many ways. In many situations, and it can be really inspiring instead of to be if the situation that you could kind of get sad or really emotional and down, so you can find in that moment when you are really going down, in that moment you can really start to cultivate Sisu. And I guess Sisu is also part of the story that we are independent country, because we were only how many people against Russia?
How many? What is the population?
I don't remember exactly.
Roughly,
maybe the Soviet soldiers, maybe 1 million, and we were 100,000, and we were really. It was winter war, and all the men they really cultivate Sisu because it. They have been told that we are going to lose this war, but there was some of the characters such really know that not the case. We just have to cultivate Sisu. And that's the end of the story. We are independent country. So you can do whatever you want with your Sisu.
And just by the way, I'm going to interject, by the way, very recent survey of all the countries in the world, which is the best one to live in? In terms of just the whole array of things that people generally value, Finland is number one in the world.
But maybe that's because of the Sisu.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. Switzerland was number two, but Finland number one. Yeah.
But I guess kind of my personal point of view, if you have your Sisu in your heart, it's the most important that you also cultivate living love and loving kindness and compassion with it. Because you can have Sisu, but if you combine those together, then it's a kind of yin and yang, kind of really giving up even the kind of the idea of you can manifest your intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Finland is number one. Finland is number one because of sisu. And Switzerland is number two because of chocolate. That's one hypothesis. It's not been tested yet. It brings to mind, as we have just a couple of minutes left, there's a phrase I learned a little while ago I kind of like. If something is not worth doing, it's not worth doing well. So there's a time to give up when you see, this is a complete waste of time, or this is a wrong thing to do. And of course, I'm not contradicting anything you said. That was not blind sisu, like anything, never give up. You don't have a marvelous country like Finland was driven by such stupidity. But we do sometimes venture into things that upon second thought, we recognize this wasn't worth doing in the first place. And so I like that phrase. If something isn't worth doing, it's not worth doing well. I like that. It's really got a catch to me. And then we come to our practice here. And again, I find my sisu coming up. Because whatever worldview, whatever lifestyle, whether we're going to become yogis, whether we're going to become housewives or Wall Street brokers, if it's possible to cultivate a greater sense of ease, stability, and clarity, then whether it's easy or difficult, whether it's a short term or long term, that's just one of those things I figure that's just totally worth doing. That calls for sisu. You can have some rotten days. I think maybe all of you by now have had some really rotten days. Bad days. But if it's worth doing, then it's time for sisu. And that's where that conviction really comes in. Is this worth doing or not? It's not this teacher or that teacher. It's not this method, that method. How about these qualities? Are you really content with OCDD or not? Are you content with that? Because it's not going to go away by itself. That's clear. It doesn't even go away when you become senile. Then you're senile OCDD. But it's not any better, right? So it won't wear off with old age. It just gets duller. So there's OCDD versus the three qualities of shamatha. And then there's the four immeasurables. And I like to take just a really mundane view of it. Rather than thinking, oh, now we're going to become saintly. Now we've become something really special, spiritual. Now we can become religious. But just thinking, oh, come on. If we're not treating each other with equanimity, we're treating each other in a dehumanizing, disgusting way. I mean, just treating people as surfaces, appealing and unappealing, like as if they're food in a cafeteria, that's really degrading. It's unacceptable. It's unbearable. How can we do that? That's not even decent. So just to think about the four immeasurables, this is just a way to treat each other decently. Bodhicitta is something quite majestic, yes. But the four immeasurables, that's just not treating each other indecently, reductionistically, dehumanizing. It's treating each other as we are. And I was thinking again then, as the minutes run out, that so often we're thinking there's wisdom and that there's skillful means, wisdom and compassion. And it's true. And they can be complementary, they can enrich each other. Especially these shamatha methods that we're focusing on. Each one is so fertile, so ripe, so pregnant with insight, just waiting to burst with insight. Even the mindfulness of breathing, which seems so simple. A lot of you now in your one-on-one meetings with me, you've shared with me some of the insights into your own being, what's happening in your mind, the depths of unveiling, what's going on in your... It's just a path of self-discovery, and you think... Path of self-discovery, you're watching the tactile sensations at your nostrils. Yeah, that's right. That's the technique. And it is really a path of self-discovery. And that's just following the sensations of the nose, let alone settling the mind. Boy, is that, you know, right next to Vipassana, path of insight, let alone this deep insight in the very nature of awareness itself. So we would say, well, wisdom is on that side, right? That's where we're really tapping into deeper reality. But wait a minute. We just practice equanimity. What was that other than a wisdom practice? Because delusion is looking at attractive, unattractive, unattractive, neutral, attractive, unattractive, like, don't like. There's no wisdom in that. A frog can do that. Tasty fly, untasty ant. Tasty fly, untasty cockroach. Tasty, you know. That doesn't take any wisdom at all. A frog can do that very, very well. You know, tasty and untasty. Frogs got it nailed, right? But equanimity, where we have the eyes of wisdom to look through the veneer, the eyes of wisdom not to look too deeply, that we've gone off into emptiness, where sentient beings have now all vanished, right? The eyes of wisdom to look with sufficient depth until we're seeing something real and important and meaningful, and that there's a sentient being. Sentient being, sentient being. Looking back. That's just real. And so equanimity, a heart that is evenly open and caring, is just realistic. It has no icing in it, it has nothing more than that. Really, it's just realistic. Right? And being realistic, it's good. And being realistic, it's virtue. But it's not something in addition to being realistic. Just being realistic. And if we're realistic in the recognition too that our own well-being is not isolated, not independent, it's just true. It's just not isolated, independent from those around us. It's so obvious in a community here where we do have something of a light boundary of this group here. It's so obvious, isn't it? How our well-being is interdependent, even that everybody has their own room. But even here, our well-being is interdependent. And that's just real. And if that's just true, and that's all it is, it's just true, then the notion of not caring about someone else is being untrue. It's being unrealistic. Because it would be like the left hand saying, right hand, you're on your own. The back of your hand itches, your problem, figure it out. So I'm not helping. I'm not you. You're on your own over there. Oh, come on. That's just normal. Oh, I actually do have now. The tip of my nose itches. I'm not a nose. Are you a nose? I'm not a nose. Then we're out of here. This is not our business. It's up in the head's problem. These are really stupid hands. They think they're on their own. The left hand won't help the right hand, and neither one of them will help the nose. Oh. Now that feels good. Thank you, hand, but you don't really need to be thanked because you're part of the same program, so you just did what was normal. You scratched the nose when it itched. It wasn't anything special. We don't get the Nobel Prize for the right hand because it scratched the nose. It's just... there's an awareness that it's all of a piece. So Shantideva gives this analogy, you remember? Gives this analogy of the world of sentient beings. Every sentient being is like a body part. And we rightly laugh when we think the left hand wouldn't help the right hand, or neither one will help the nose, which is so far away. You know, different continent. It's a different continent. A different continent. I don't help people on other continents. We just help the limbs. And then the liver says, oh yeah, then you're not getting any of my blood. No, I'm not going to give you any of my clean blood, and so forth. So then in this way, kind of the division between the wisdom and the compassion just kind of melts away. It melts away. And as I mentioned before, and it is so important, when one starts to gain some insight into identitylessness, the lack of some inherent self, the lack of I, me, mine within the five skandhas, apart from the five skandhas, when this insight comes up and that's authentic, it's not just something cerebral, but something authentic coming from experience, that insight is liberating and it opens the heart and compassion tends to flow right out of that insight. So it's wisdom giving birth to greater caring, loving kindness, compassion. When it's really embedded in practice, in Dharma, and not just a book about, one more book about the illusion of the self. So, then the whole duality between shamatha over here, the four immeasurables over there, wisdom over here, compassion over there, starts to happily blur, good blurring. We just see it's all of a piece. And it's called letting your mind become Dharma. Voilà, so. So let's recall the default mode of silence, speak when we see that it's really meaningful, and enjoy our precious time here.